CliffCentral.com. Thursday morning, the last burning platform of 2019. It's brought to you by Nando's every single week, and we get to talk about all the most important issues on the national, international agenda. And this morning's no different. It's also our returning champions, Canton Pillay and Pumi Mashiko's first reunion in ages.
Did you say returning champion?
Yeah, you're both returning champions. Of course you are. It's a boxing match. Listen, people loved the way that you two used to fight, and then suddenly you would both agree. And it's kind of like we all have. And at Christmas time, this is what happens. You get around the dinner table with family that are massive supporters of the ANC or of Donald Trump or of Bernie Sanders or of Jeremy Corbyn or of Boris Johnson. And you get around the table with these people and you can't believe you're related to them.
But where's the turkey?
Exactly. So, this morning, let's begin. You are the flavor of Twitter this morning. I see you're a trending subject. Can you talk about this?
No, but I've deactivated my Twitter account. And look, it's nothing to do with...
You're not afraid of Twitter.
No, it's not that I'm afraid of.
People are going to say that.
Yeah, but there's been a sheer outpouring of invective and abuse and...
Yeah, I see.
And personal insults and... and it's just not worth the effort to hang on there right now, so it's been deactivated. And there are some things that are best handled outside of Twitter, and I'm going to be doing exactly that.
All right. Well, this is something which we'll observe over the next few days. So you've deactivated your account. You can't talk very much about it, but I see like Julius Malema is saying ENCA must fall. So the must fall is back. They've pulled that out of mothballs, which is exciting. I'm not going to comment. Pumi, anything you want to say?
So 2 days ago, we were speaking about reporting the news and being the news. And my feeling is if you're reporting the news, you can't be the news. Really, you can't be the news. Because even though you're allowed to have a point of view, you still have to have all the tenets around journalism and fairness and openness and giving opportunity for the conversation to be a conversation and not a one-sided event.
Well, Twitter has made that impossible. Twitter has, I would think, degraded news and degraded conversation and degraded debate to a point where it is no longer a useful, practical place for anyone to have any thoughtful ideas and for anyone to share those thoughtful ideas with other people.
Well,
no, I think there's still space.
There's a significant point, though, that I actually want to go into, and let me just see if I can actually find this, because I normally carry this type of information floating around on... And yes, here we go. So, I was pulling statistics recently in terms of what our social media footprint is like as South Africans.
Sure.
And check these out, you know. So
this is the latest on South African social media. Facebook has 23 million people. It's up 4.5%, and it's about a 50-50 male-female
split. Yeah.
LinkedIn, 6.9 million. It's much bigger than all the others, okay? Facebook's the biggest, then LinkedIn, then Instagram, then Twitter, then Snapchat.
Yes, but look at the numbers in terms of Twitter.
Well, Twitter's got only 1.67 million people. It's down 27%.
Absolutely, yes.
And the split's 37 to 63, female to male. So one third, or just less than a third, just more than a third, female, and the rest male.
Yes.
So Twitter is failing horribly.
Yes,
and it's become such a violent, ugly, toxic
absolutely,
place.
Absolutely, and people have been leaving.
But
we learned earlier this year, leading into the election, is that Twitter is not necessarily a reflection of the public or what the public thinks or feels.
But we've got political parties who think that's the reality.
Well, a very good example was the UK elections that have just happened, where if you look in terms of the measurements around social media presence, Jeremy Corbyn took that as a point of pride that their social media campaign had been really extremely effective, and he was absolutely right. Their social media presence on every conceivable level was significantly better than Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
And
Didn't make a difference.
Yeah, in fact, Boris Johnson hardly had any presence on Twitter to really speak of. Jeremy Corbyn, you know, said his pronouns and everything. But when it came down to the results, what you had was an entirely different picture that's happening on the ground. And one of the reasons for that is that what happens in terms of Twitter is when the slightest thing that you end up saying ends up getting twisted and distorted and taking out of context.
Mm-hmm.
What then happens is that people have a propensity to not express any opinions in that forum anymore. And those discussions get driven underground.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So and they get taken out of the public sphere where they could be useful or damaging, and they get relayed into places that are dark.
Exactly. So now you had a scenario in the UK elections where there was such invective against Boris Johnson at every conceivable level in terms of social media that anyone who was even considering discussing the possibility of voting for Boris Johnson would never have expressed their opinion in public. But in the sanctity of the ballot box, when they're alone with their conscience, they go ahead and do what they've been thinking about and no doubt discussing with their friends and with their families. And you had this result where you had constituencies that have been owned by the Labour Party for generations, and now for the first time have turned around.
Flipping. Well, yes. Before we move on from these numbers, because they're really interesting, forget about the male-female bias, that's not so interesting. Snapchat's pretty much stagnant at 1.35 million. Not really important, but it's younger people. Twitter, 1.67 million people. When people tell you that Twitter is a great place for you to get a gauge on South African politics, it really isn't. But what's significant is that minus 27%.
Yes.
So I suppose that's for the year, right?
That's a decline, yes.
That's the source is Digital 2019 in South Africa, so that's a reputable source. Down 27% just this year alone. I can't wait for Twitter to completely disappear. Instagram, 4 million people, and that's up 5.3%. Because on Instagram, people don't get into these discussions.
Sure.
Retweet nonsense. Pass on fake news. Start spewing invective at each other. LinkedIn is obviously a useful business tool. I can't believe LinkedIn is bigger than Instagram and Twitter. At 6.9 million.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Isn't that interesting?
But if you consider that the biggest problem that we have as a nation is unemployment,
then LinkedIn
then
makes
it actually makes sense because LinkedIn actually becomes that place to do networking.
Well, I just want to refer to something. You mentioned Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson, and it was the week of the UK elections. And I think a lot of people were shocked by the result just because they think social media is the real world. But these are some of the – you've got to hear this. These are people on the street. This woman is wearing a Fuck Boris shirt, okay? And she's clearly a well-educated girl who's probably in the elite in England. She certainly doesn't seem to have – if you judge her by her accent, and that's always the best way to judge anyone English – she doesn't seem to have had a couple of nights as a rough sleeper in her life. She's pretty much one of those kids who's got the opinion she's got because it's cool. Listen to how she speaks and the people she's with, how they speak about the election results. Just you figure out if these are the kind of people that you would want supporting you. All right, listen to this.
Fuck Boris.
Fuck Boris.
Yeah.
Fuck racism. Fuck homophobia. Fuck all you pigs.
Fuck all the money in the offshore account. We want to save our NHS. It's important. We need it.
You're not our Prime Minister.
He is a pig, and I'm so ashamed that he's the Prime Minister of my country. It's disgusting, and I wish him the worst. I wish him a horrible death. I don't know if you're allowed to put that online, but he's fucking everything up. For people my age, our future, I plan to work in the NHS. I plan to be a doctor. I plan to actually care about people. And he doesn't care. And to see working class people caring about Boris Johnson, they're shooting themselves in the face. It's disgusting. And yeah, I wish him the worst. Go fuck yourself, Boris Johnson. Honestly, what a cunt. Sorry.
Now, that girl's going to be a doctor one day. She's just wished someone a horrible death, and she's going to be a doctor one day.
Well, she said she's going to care for people someday.
Yeah, well, it's obvious to all of us that that she's not a caring person. You know, this is the funny thing, is it's like she cares about the NHS, but she doesn't really care about anything. It's more important for her to be anti-something than it is for her to do something. I mean, I watched that straight afterwards, and I thought, you know what? He is your prime minister, and he's exactly the one you deserve. And he's not anti-NHS, by the way. He's the most socially liberal prime minister in a long time.
Absolutely. If you looked at him in terms of Margaret Thatcher terms, the guy's positively a leftist.
Mm.
Because he's looking in terms of ramping up spending on critical things instead of...
taking on big government projects. He's talking about reworking things, the economy.
You don't even have to look at him in terms of a Margaret Thatcher. He just bought a winning ticket. We always talk about this, and that politicians are looking for power. So he bought a winning ticket. Jeremy Corbyn had... he was lukewarm at the best of times. Boris Johnson came out there. He was strong about what he wanted. He was clear about the fact that he's pushing for Brexit. He was clear. It's
what, get it done.
But it is also, it's the thing that we here in South Africa, yeah, look at our government. So 2 years ago, Cyril Ramaphosa becomes the new president of the ANC, and we think, here's a guy that gets the job done. He's going to make decisions. He's going to do things. And then...
nothing.
Wow.
Crickets.
But that's what people want. People just want you to say, I'm going to do this, and then do it. They don't care about your, like, wishy-washy. And Boris Johnson wanted to be... he came from left field. He was just...
yeah.
Who is Boris Johnson? He waited his time out. He waited to see how the chips fall around the Brexit thing. And then he came in, and then he said, okay, we're going to do it, guys. We're going to do it, because this is what the referendum
his
says.
His timing was immaculate, because he could have taken over after David Cameron and had that poison chalice that Theresa May had.
Absolutely. And he didn't. He waited it out. He was like, let Theresa deal with it.
But
let's see how she...
as much, and we will go to South African news first, because I think there's plenty for you two to argue about when it comes to the local politics. But just on this matter, Jeremy Corbyn was so unsavory and such a complete loser for the Labour Party that even people who would die hard, as Canton said, you know, blue-collar workers from working-class neighbourhoods who'd voted Labour their whole life, were persuaded quite easily to vote for the Tories in this election. He's got an overwhelming mandate now to move ahead with Brexit.
A strong mandate.
And I think that the kind of thing we've just heard from these kids on the street complaining about Boris is just the same noise that we find on the social media that Canton's just given us statistics for.
But again, it's noise that's entirely based on disinformation.
Mm.
And, you know, let's take homophobia as a very specific example. I've actually gone through Boris Johnson's history pretty much with a fine-tooth comb to try and look for traces of homophobia in the sense that we would apply it to, let's say, the Bible Belt in the U.S.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's real homophobia, where there's, you know, specific campaigns that actually effectively put out the death sentence on homosexuals. Yeah, pretty much the way it happens in Central Africa these
but
days.
But calling people names is real violence, Canton. What's wrong with you?
But
calling people names, using horrible words, that's real violence.
The thing is, Boris Johnson has been a great politician. He says the things that people want to hear him say so that they vote for him. Now he's got the mandate. Now he's got the power. He makes the decisions that he makes. He's got his cabinet, right? People are looking at his cabinet and they're going, this Boris Johnson, he was all like, fuckboys and
yeah,
what? And now, how is he allowing these fuckboys into his cabinet? How is he allowing women of color? But what he did was he said, I know what you want to hear, and I will give you what you want to hear so that you give me what I want, and what I want is power. Now he's got the power,
yeah,
and now he's making the decisions he's always wanted to make.
We don't seem to apply that cynicism when we see an idiot like, who's the Canadian Prime Minister? Justin Trudeau. We see him appointing, you know, more women in his cabinet than anywhere else, and constantly he's obsessed with this idea that it must be 50-50 no matter what, where and when and who and how. And he's trying to put this person in there because they need a Native American head of this department and all kinds of things, all identity politics. So Boris plays that game and says, fine, I'll do the same thing. Suddenly it's because he's not being honest. He's just playing the game. Justin Trudeau is a hero. Obama was a hero. But Trump and Boris can't possibly be by playing by the same rules. And they win.
Well, Boris has never actually wanted to play identity politics. So if you look at all of the stuff that he's talked about, the fact that he actually implements a diverse cabinet has got nothing to do with his political positioning.
The two most important departments in his cabinet, that of Home Secretary and the Chancellor of the Exchequer, are both Indian-Pakistani first-generation immigrants.
Yes.
So it's interesting. How racist could he be? So he's used some words that they dug up on, I don't know, social media from 800 years ago when everybody used those words because that was how everybody spoke. It's just amazing how the standards are applied so hypocritically. Anyway, we do have real news to get to, and there are some things going on here locally that I know Pumi and Canton are itching to argue about. So first of all, let's just look at Pumi's favorite president, Cyril Ramaphosa. He has snuck in during the quietest time of the year some land expropriation laws, and Cabinet says it's on track with changes to land expropriation. On Tuesday, they said the following. They said, an ad hoc parliamentary committee was established earlier this year to examine ways that the Constitution would allow for expropriation without compensation. And in a parallel process, the Presidential Advisory Panel on Land Reform came up with 73 recommendations on how to proceed. Cabinet accepted 60 of those and said the panel needed to do some more work on the remainder and find consensus. But I'm always cynical about when and where these things happen. So they're doing it in the week before Christmas. Should we be extra suspicious? Or is this just part of what's happening?
The crucial thing for me is what's the deadline by which submissions have to be entertained around this stuff?
I don't know.
I haven't had a chance to drill down into that detail yet, precisely because it is heading up to the Christmas period.
You know, so...
And this committee is led by our friend David Mabuza, who's the deputy president.
Have you seen the DA's response?
No, because I'm not really a big reader of DA press releases, but do tell us, because you clearly are.
It's not a press release. So they're running a huge campaign of petitions using all the inflammatory words that you need.
Yes.
Stop the ANC, because they want to take away your land, your business, your home. And I'm just like, guys, really? This has been a conversation that has been ongoing for the better part of the past 5 years. And there are lots of levers in place for people to be part of this conversation, for people to make their submissions, for people... And for as long as we've had our constitution has been very clear about the issue of land redistribution. What is still unclear, even as the commissions are there, even as the various people leading various parliamentary and presidential wara-waras, is how all of this is going to work. It's great to have the laws.
And let's
if
remember,
they're unimplementable.
Yes, then it's moot, right? And you're referring to the same people who we've entrusted to manage SAA and ESCOM. So, don't worry. Am I wrong?
Calm down to a slight quiver.
Everybody gets into a panic about these things, and the DA loves to panic the most. But I'm kind of with you. These are not the kind of people who implement anything effectively, so don't worry.
How? What are the gears in place? How will this work?
Now, can we talk, well, since I brought up ESCOM, can I ask you two for the latest news on this and your comments thereon? Energy Minister Gwede Mantashe, he's the guy, by the way, who's holding back independent power producers from contributing to the grid and making some money in the process.
Well, he's apparently made some progress in that regard.
He has?
Yes, because he's apparently been fast-tracking some of those applications.
Thank God, because that's one of the few things that has been done in that department in this year.
Absolutely, yeah.
But he says that on Tuesday we are going to continue burning coal to generate electricity. He doesn't give a shit about the environment. He's not interested in activists from that quadrant. He says even as the continent's biggest greenhouse gas emitter, that's us, adopts more renewable energy sources, we are not going to stop burning coal. That's what he said.
Because we saw more of Gwede Mantashe when he was at Luthuli House than he is in government. Now that he actually has a role to play, now that we actually want to hear what it is that he's saying, we never see Gwede Mantashe. We never see Gwede. When he was at Luthuli House, he had a press conference every other day.
Every other day.
Every other day. He had some kind of pronouncement to make. He had
but you never see the tiger until it strikes.
Where?
All right. Do you have anything else?
Pumia didn't have a response to that.
I shall not dignify that with a response.
Apparently, listen
to
this.
I shall not dignify that with a response.
The International Energy Agency report, which predicted global coal demand would remain stable until 2024 as growth in Asia offsets weaker Western demand, was published on Tuesday. Gwede says, it's not interesting, this stuff. We've got to burn coal. And frankly, I think most South Africans would agree with him, because at this stage we don't have a lot of options. Am I wrong?
Well, there's also the fact that we have the coal. and let's burn it.
The most amazing thing for me around this Eskom debacle is how the president has literally put his cock on the block with this one. So he comes out to say, after much, much flustering, right? He comes out to say that he is assuring the nation that there will be no outages for a period of 2 weeks over the Christmas holiday. So we are getting a break of this. And all that does is it puts him in a very precarious position, because now, if he can in fact deliver on that, we're all going to be asking ourselves, why is it that if a presidential decree can stop this from happening? Right?
Can I give you a very quick and effective explanation? It's because most of the major industries have actually scaled back during this period. And so demand is going to be down during this period. So at the point at which the president is making that call, it's not that he's actually putting in place a decree that says you're going to keep pumping, burning diesel. It's got everything to do with actually understanding the way in which the supply and demand is working. So at that level, I think, you know, saying that...
But what it does do is it then puts him in a precarious position, that even as we know that demand has gone down, everybody is now asking themselves, how? If Cyril can make this announcement
it's our job to explain this to people.
And then it works out. And then everybody's like, so why is this such a problem? And then it puts Cyril in a very serious bind when... Come January, come February, we're back to square one because we are unable to deliver on it. And then they have to privatize parts of this. Then that's what he wanted all along, the Cyril. He was trying to get all of these things privatized. He's fucked himself. He's hoist himself with this one.
Oh, Pumi, I'm glad your love for Cyril is undiminished.
Shame, man.
Prepare yourselves, because in the last 10 or so minutes of this morning's Burning Platform, we will get to the Trump impeachment. Dun, dun, dun. The big story that isn't. But we still have some local stuff to get to, because there's lots going on. War against the financial sector. This is what Julius Malema said. The EFF are going to target the banks. It's amazing to me that...
Well, they targeted VBS very successfully.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Mm-hmm. This is a group of people who have got most of their sustenance from one of the crooked banks that's now no longer. And they stole money from poor people using those banks. If there's anyone you shouldn't trust using the word bank in a sentence, it's Julius. So he and the EFF have signaled they will embark on an aggressive campaign against the banks next year. The financial sector must be fought, he says. 2020, it's a war against the financial sector. We need to tell them that no one is above the power of our people, he told delegates at the party's National Elective Conference. Of course, if you are a people and you don't like banks, just don't put your money in the banks. You always have that option.
How was that boycott they organized against APSA?
It's gone nowhere. Of course. Okay. Yeah,
was there a boycott against APSA? I missed this.
You don't remember?
Oh, they even had a march and everything.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I missed that.
They had a march and everything.
Oh, maybe it
Ray Hartley spent
maybe,
a good
maybe
amount
it was so
of
long
time.
Ago that I've forgotten. It must have been at least like a month ago, right?
Ray Hartley had a great time figuring out exactly how many people showed up to the march against.
It was single digits.
It was... anyway.
Guys, if I can just swing back for a second to our earlier conversation apropos of EWC.
Mm. Expropriation without compensation.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Parliament of the Republic of South Africa, invitation to comment on draft Constitution 18th Amendment Bill 2019. Yeah. Notice is hereby given, blah, blah, blah. Okay, should you we invite comments to be made, and they've actually given us a email address, which is section25@parliament.gov.za.
section25@parliament.gov.za. Yes. So go on and put your comments down.
Yeah, so that's the email address to submit your comments to, and yeah, but this has been gazetted.
I'd also like to tie in two of our earlier stories, the one we've just covered with the EFF.
Sorry, 31st January is the deadline.
Oh, yeah. So it is. It's, yeah. We've got a month, basically. Yeah. Yeah. And to tie together the EFF story and then that Twitter story that we started with, because Canton's all the rage on Twitter at the moment, unbeknown to him because he's not on there anymore. I wonder if you took the party support in the country and you broke that down on Twitter, what kind of interesting statistics you would find. And I wonder if the statistics for, like, the people who make the most noise on Twitter are similarly declining. You know, the kind of noisy people who really, for the longest time now, have shut out a lot of other conversation from Twitter. I wonder if those people are by far and away the majority of people on Twitter now, and whether or not you can show statistically that those are the same people who've chased everyone else off.
Oh, let me find this tweet by everybody's favorite auntie.
Which one's this?
Helen Zille.
Oh, right. She's not leaving Twitter.
Oh, God, I hope I can find it.
Canton, if there are only 1.67 million people on Twitter in South Africa, and I have 2 million followers, how does that work?
Well, it means that people who... Remember, this is people who use Twitter, not people who are...
Not people who have an account.
Not people who have an account, yeah. Okay. So, you know, when you have that many followers, but a lot of them are actually
inactive.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, they've registered over the years and they haven't come back. Twitter did have this plan that by December this year, they were going to be deactivating accounts that had not been used for years.
That would be good, right?
Well... And the reason why they stopped doing it is that there's essentially legacy accounts. These are dead people. And they did not want to be erasing that portion of history. You know, maybe a person's inactive because they're dead, but, you know, do you want to...
Well, maybe they should create an inactive Twitter.
Well, in fact, Facebook has this... I think it's called a legacy project, where basically if a person dies, then you can... You know, bring it to the attention of Facebook, and then the account effectively gets locked away. So it's still available for posterity, but
so someone who researches in a, you know, 10 years time could look it up.
Sure, you know. So I mean, there are people on Twitter who are now dead, where, you know, every so often, just, you know, to because it's still kind of interesting. I mean, Leonard Nimoy, for example.
Yes, is Star Trek.
From Star Trek. And I used to follow Leonard Nimoy, and I still every so often would drop by onto Leonard Nimoy's timeline because he would tweet really interesting philosophical stuff.
And do you still sometimes drop in on dead Leonard Nimoy?
Well, I haven't been there for recently, certainly, but probably within the past year. Yes, I think that... I have, at the point at which the new Star Trek TV series came out and everyone was flaying it on IMDb and all of those forums in terms of user reviews. And you know, just to give a sense of balance, I, you know, would hop across and see what the old guys used to say.
What Spock had to say.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Just quickly, Pumi, I did say to you yesterday we would spend a proportion of today's Burning Platform looking forward to 2020, which I think we will do now. Are there things that you would like to reflect on before we throw 2019 into the rubbish bin?
Oh, God, this has been a long year. It's been a long news year.
Yeah.
Like, we don't even remember things that happened in March.
No, it's been... And if you do look up news events from this year, and you realize, wow, that was this year?
Uh-huh.
you suddenly get a bit of a panic attack. You think, my God, it feels like it has gone on for ages. And there are stories that are probably worth referring to, because if you look back on this year, I wonder how much of it is stuff that people will look back on fondly and how much of it is stuff that people will look back on with less excitement. I mean, it's been the year of Greta Thunberg, of Hong Kong, of Donald Trump, of Boris Johnson, of Jussie Smollett, of Venezuela, of Christchurch, of Notre Dame, of Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, these are all things that happened just in the last 12 months.
Wow.
You know, this year has been so hectic, no one is actually doing it like decades lists. People have actually, like, the politics of the decade, people are just like, we don't have the bandwidth. We don't have the bandwidth because there's so much shit that has happened in politics this year.
What would you like to think 2020 might hold for us? And what do you think the big political stories of the next year are going to be?
What? Next year is going to be super exciting. There's elections all around.
There's the U.S. election, which we'll get to in a minute.
There's the U.S. election. There's a new cabinet in the U.K., which is also always a fascinating thing to watch. We still, here in South Africa, are going to be having a terrible time with our economy, not just because South Africa's economy is bad, but also because of the way that the world economy is constituted. And then we're going to be watching in free fall all sorts of political careers here in South Africa. Yesterday I also saw a very interesting article quoting our departed mayor,
Herman
Mashaba.
Yeah.
Who which it was a very bizarre headline. So what they quoted is very bizarre. It's like, he is willing to consider coming back as the mayor of Joburg if South Africa wants it.
Send him the clarion call.
There's so many things wrong with that. First of all, no one voted for Herman Mashaba. No one voted for
Herman. No, that's not true. I voted. People vote. I voted for Herman Mashaba.
You voted for Herman
DA? No, I voted for Herman specifically.
Specifically,
yeah,
Herman.
I did. Gareth, we've talked about this before, that I voted for Herman
and
because...
And it was a bitter disappointment.
It was a bitter disappointment. I admit to it. You know, I screwed up big time there. But remember that Herman Mashaba, for years, was heading up the Free Market Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And... the stuff that he used to say back in the day was absolutely brilliant. And I used to, and I had reason to think that Herman Mashaba, coming in as mayor of Johannesburg, would do the basic stuff, you know, that he would clean the streets, he would fix the potholes and fix the traffic lights. And I voted for Herman Mashaba specifically.
And
by the same token, I'd like to think that there are a lot of people who voted for Cyril as opposed to voting for the ANC.
Shame.
And they're also disappointed.
And they're also bitterly disappointed.
Life is full of disappointments.
But
so what are you disappointed?
The fascinating thing for me about Herman is that now that he has tasted the power of politics, he's not going back to whatever his day job was. Now he wants it. He wants it back. Now he wants to be.
But the language.
Even though he was like, I'm not a politician. I'm just a business person. I'm just a citizen that wants the right things for my city. Now.
So where did Herman make this statement?
It was in News 24. I think he was speaking
News
with 24, a journalist.
But I like the way he said, if the people
of South Africa, man.
Yeah, if you want me back, I can be recalled from my retirement to come and serve you, the people of South Africa. Like, we're all clamoring. You know, maybe if he'd been amazing, like Giuliani or who was before de Blasio, Bloomberg was in New York, then we would go, wow, you know, that's the mayor we want. He's the guy we should entrust more power to. Let's vote him in nationally. But he and Musi are both looking more and more like people who just got kicked off.
Let me tell you something interesting. In my suburb, after the ANC mayor was appointed, for the first time since 2016, the Verge has actually got mowed. The traffic lights that have been out of action on the corner of Woodmead and Old Pretoria Road, suddenly those started working again. The potholes that were on Witkoppen that are between Old Pretoria Road and Woodmead Drive suddenly got fixed for the first time.
This is the world of an ANC mayor. In Canton's neighborhood anyway. Anecdotal evidence from Canton that the ANC do things right occasionally.
No, what I do think is that they are actually trying to get brownie points in a very short term.
They had sabotaged Herman.
Yes, and you know what? I'm all for it, guys. If you're actually going to be turning in that very basic level of service delivery, that's really what I'm looking for.
That's what we really do care about, right?
Yes.
It's not the national politics. Well, there are two comments here that I just want to quickly address. The first one, why has the VBS scandal gone away with the EFF? Why are they so quiet on it? Or are there ongoing investigations? Where is the public prosecutor in this matter? It is carrying on. But it is less and less of an important story, and this is why Julius blusters and makes noise so that he can distract you from the fact that they stole from poor people. And then someone wanted here for Canton. This is from Basitsana. She says, is Canton going to address the ENCA thing? No, he said at the beginning he can't. He's taken himself off of Twitter. He's deactivated his account because this is it's a labor dispute, effectively, and he has to shut up about it because he's a boss and there's a situation that he can't comment on with any detail at this point. Fair enough. Okay, so that's why we're not... But he did address Twitter, which is interesting. So if you want to listen to that, you might have missed the beginning of the show, Basitsana. You can go back and listen to that. All right, so we've got Herman. What else is on your agenda for 2020?
Ooh.
Are there EFF... Tell me.
This is Canton. What was the thing that you said
last week they must
take the wheel. If they really want to impress you, they must take the wheel.
Yeah, exactly.
The EFF coming out of their conference, their second one, right, have made quite a lot of noises, quite a lot of promises. It'll be fascinating to see how all of this
they spoke about
rolls out.
One
in
thing
the next
that
couple
I'd
of
like
years.
Your comments on, both of you, is open borders in Africa. This is a big, audacious goal from them, and they need to put some of this stuff in so that people don't, you know, forget that they're there. And they need to throw these things in just to remind their base, who are, you know, hungry for this stuff, that they actually have something on the plate for next year. The EFF, to their credit, they led this land expropriation without compensation thing. They were ahead of the ANC and they drove ANC policy in that direction. They managed to get hold of the reins. So when they want to do something, they can sometimes get it done, the EFF. Do you think that any of the policies they discussed at their Congress are going to become things that we should pay attention to?
Look, I think open borders are an interesting thing. And, well, Pumi's actually raising eyebrows. Pumi, you go first. Go on.
I'm not raising eyebrows. Event.
Do you want to express an opinion on open borders, Pumi?
Arched my eyebrows.
Uh-huh.
No. You know, the thing that struck me with all of the stuff that was coming out of the EFF conference is how a lot of those policies are very similar to old PAC stuff.
Yeah.
So they're just reiterating stuff that used to be there, mm-hmm. and they're just repackaging it and putting it out there. And what that... for me symbolizes is, you know, unfortunately the EFF doesn't have the political depth, as it were, to be out in full force and having their own identity. They're trying to pull the ANC to the left.
Yeah, because, you know, again, we're getting distracted now by talking about the EFF. But
we're talking about the EFF.
No. Let's talk about the open border stuff. Because
it is an EFF policy. We're talking about the EFF policies.
Yes, it's an EFF policy. But again, one needs to actually drill down into what does an open borders actually mean.
Mm-hmm.
So let me give you an example of where I think open borders are good. I think open borders are good in terms of free trade and free movement of money. Okay, so that's a very specific example. I think it's important that we be able to move our goods north of the Limpopo and back and get paid a fair rate for it, and for people north of the Limpopo to move their goods into our country and get paid a fair rate for it without having governments imposing absurd tariffs around this stuff. I do think that we need open borders at the level of having really effective transportation that crosses the borders. So during apartheid, for example, and we've talked about this before as well, we had trains that ran from Johannesburg to Maputo. We had trains that ran from Durban through to Harare. And now those train lines are just shut off, as an example. So once again, we currently do have open borders to some extent. They're porous.
Correct.
Because we have the workforce that we are dependent upon in this country from Zimbabwe, and they move back and forth across our borders without much difficulty at all. The difficulty comes for people that we really want to cross the borders. So, for example, if we were able to take teachers from Zimbabwe and inject them into our school system, that would be something for me that would be a very good thing to do. So the question of when we talk about open borders, we have to try and get a sense of exactly what we're referring to. But the other question that we need to take into account is that if we have an open border situation where effectively you end up with people crossing the border who get exactly the same rights and benefits that are being paid for by South African taxpayers, that becomes a recipe for disaster, because then resentment builds and xenophobia flows from that. And so which is why you need immigration as a different thing from open borders to be handled in a very structured manner. I'm not entirely sure which of those things we are talking about here, so we need to drill down. But as soon as you have a catchphrase like open borders, it all depends on how you interpret it.
So, but that's my point about the EFF's lack of depth. They use lots of emotive language that they put out there that catches everybody. And we were talking about Boris Johnson saying the right things and doing whatever he pleases on the other side. That's what the EFF tends to do, is they tend to go, what is it that will make people feel good? And we're going to just put it out there. And then they don't have the depth that anchors it on the other side of it. And and that's why it's so hard for them to deliver on so many things. You know, so they are just, and then we have so many dubious things around the EFF. We have, you know, we have issues around the criminality of what happened with VBS. And when that is being questioned and when they are taken to task about that, it becomes, again, I'm not going to address this thing, I'm going to become emotional about it.
Right. Yeah. It
very
it
much
is,
like a toddler. But is, they are a new party.
They're a bunch of toddlers.
They are a new party.
And in policy terms, they do lack depth.
They're getting there. They will get there. And they have to
I don't think
start
a lot of,
somewhere.
I don't think a lot of their voters are that interested in depth, to be perfectly honest. I don't think there's a massive interest in detail.
Most voters just want, they want what Canton wants. They want the roads to work. They want the you know, they want the robots to work. They want their rubbish collected. That's what most voters want. People want what they need to make their lives comfortable, which is why emotive language works.
Well, let's stick to the emotive language theme, because we've got a couple of minutes left of the Burning Platform this morning. And yesterday, the Democrats managed to impeach Donald Trump in the House. This has absolutely zero effect on A, his presidency, and B, on the workings of Congress from here on forward, because it still has to go to the Senate, where it will be put on trial, and he's probably not going to be found guilty by the Senate, which means, of course, that he carries on being president and probably gets reelected next year. But this is an attempt by the Democrats to start a fight before the elections that they hope to win. Now, interestingly enough, Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff and all of the people who've been driving this impeachment narrative so hard and really have been led by the nose by the left of the Democratic Party, chiefly these people I'm about to play a clip for you of, they've been saying it's very solemn. You know, to impeach a president is a serious matter. And you've seen endless political pundits on CNN and MSNBC and in the New York Times and respectable, reputable media outlets like that saying this is a very serious moment. And Donald Trump being impeached shows you how this terrible man has finally been brought to his knees by the people of Congress, the people who America elected to keep checks and balances. And this solemnity is contrasted for me hugely by the fact that here we've got what they call Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib,
the squad,
Ilhan Omar, and I always forget the fourth one. She's like the Beatle, nobody remembers. She's like the Ringo Starr of the group. What is her name? cannot remember her name. Anyway, here they are. Hashtag defend our democracy. Hashtag 13th district strong. Here are the squad celebrating after the impeachment of Donald Trump in the House. Listen to this.
Hey, everyone. I am on my way to the United States House floor to impeach President Trump. On behalf of my incredible district, 13th district strong. Let's do this. Hey, everyone.
This is so exciting. And they're all waving and they're all walking into the Congress together. So exciting. The squad. What do we think of this? What do we think of Donald Trump having been impeached? Oh, by the way, her name is, what is it? Ayanna Pressley. That's right. Ayanna Pressley is the fourth member of the squad. Who would remember? So what do we think of Donald Trump being impeached? Go on. Canton, you start.
If I was in Donald Trump's position right now, what I would actually be doing is taking this impeachment to the Supreme Court.
Really?
Well, the reason why I would take it to the Supreme Court is if you look in terms of what's necessary to impeach a president of the United States, it has to fit that specific category of high crimes and misdemeanors.
Mm-hmm.
And that has not been proved in this case. High crimes and there's not even prima facie evidence of a high crime and misdemeanor.
People are saying... But this is the level of emotive language that Pumi was talking about and the level of understanding that you actually have to bring a definition of what these crimes are. And we haven't... Bribery's been sidelined as a potential crime that Donald Trump committed because there isn't any evidence for that. This whole impeachment thing has been a bit of a sham, but there are people on Twitter right now, Twitter again, going, oh my God, Trump isn't president anymore, guys.
You know,
we're dealing with a lot of stupid people.
But I think the worst thing about the impeachment situation is that it keeps Donald Trump in the news. Going into 2021, we talk about this all the time in our business, Gareth, about primacy and recency, right? So Donald Trump is the news. And we know how he so deftly knows how to turn everything into, this is a big win for me. This, you know, this is great. And what that does is it keeps him in the news. So what happened, if you think back a couple of years when Obama and Hillary were having that incredible fight with each other for the seats to be the
in the primaries.
In the primaries. What that did was it kept everybody else out. It gave them less time on the news. So everybody's talking about Hillary. Everybody's talking about Obama. Obama and Hillary. So there's less time dedicated to the Republicans at the time or the Republican policies. Now, all we're doing, and we saw this with the last election, Donald Trump all but dominated the news, whether he was tweeting stuff that was outrageous, when people go out to vote, a lot of people still go out to vote with a very emotional, sitting there in that ballot box all by yourself, is you're thinking, what have I heard? Who's saying this? Very few people walk into a ballot box thinking about policies, thinking, if I vote for this person, there are all of these policies. A lot of people vote with what's top of mind for them. What is the most top of mind person? What have I heard the most about? Who have I heard about? And the problem with the impeachment is that Donald Trump is going to be able to say, this is a great win. These Democrats suck. And what he's going to do is he's going to dominate the news cycles in every way.
Would you say that is a major miscalculation on the Democrats' part?
Also, but they're not. So as the process continues, they don't even have the numbers that are going to be on their side, you know? So are they going to get it? Are they going to get him thrown out? Are they going to get him disqualified for it? No, they're not.
Yeah. So it's a pointless exercise, which is exactly what I said.
Yeah, but again,
they're out of options.
But the reason why it's gotten to this stage is because of the people on the fringes making so much noise, that it was really difficult for Pelosi to not actually start an impeachment process, even though one could conceivably think that her heart is not necessarily in it.
Well, I don't think she was. In the beginning, she made it very clear that she thought impeachment was a bad road to go down.
Yes.
Yeah.
As did Chuck Schumer at the time. And this Adam Schiff and the squad seem to be driving the direction of the Democrats, which is why I played you that clip. But Canton is absolutely right, according to somebody here. There is no crime or misdemeanor in the articles of impeachment. The first impeachment for literally nothing. It's purely political.
Correct. And so, and Trump's point that this, in fact, opens up the floodgates for any party that's in opposition that has control of the House to then impeach a sitting president.
Hmm.
And unfortunately, what we're seeing worldwide, this lurch to the right, as people keep saying, is actually because there are no new ideas on the left. Because the left has no new ideas. They're not putting anything on the table that anybody can back or vote for. They seem to be on a back foot that's saying they're anti-everything. They're anti-whatever the right is saying. And that's not what people want. People want strong leadership. And what strong leadership looks like to people is it looks like a definitive plan of action. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to get it done. That's what people want. And that's what people vote for, because that's what they're seeking out of leadership. And the left is simply wishy-washy. You know, when you see Jeremy Corbyn, wishy-washy. When you see, like you say, Trudeau, wishy-washy. Yeah. You know?
Bernie Warren.
Wishy-washy. Mm.
But I urge us, you know, to actually spend time. Go to the White House website, where there's a copy of the letter that was sent from Trump to Pelosi, where he addresses all of the issues around impeachment. And he says, your first claim, abuse of power, is completely disingenuous, meritless, and baseless invention of your imagination. You know that I had a totally innocent conversation with the president of Ukraine. I then had a second conversation that has been misquoted, mischaracterized, and fraudulently misrepresented. Fortunately, there was a transcript of the conversation taken, and you know from the transcript, which was made immediately available, that the paragraph in question was perfect. I said to President Zelensky, I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. I said, do us a favor, not me, and our country, not a campaign. I then mentioned the Attorney General of the United States. Every time I talk with a foreign leader, I put America's interests first, as I did with President Zelensky.
Yep.
And so, again, it comes down to the fact that if you want to say that this was something that was actually trying to impose a particular viewpoint on Zelensky, it certainly didn't work. Because Zelensky turned around and said, I didn't get a sense at all that I had any pressure from this guy.
Ukrainians didn't even know that that was on the table at the time. Look, the merits of it are hopeless, which is why when they actually held the what do they call it, the committee hearings, right?
Yes.
For this impeachment trial to begin. They didn't bring any first-hand evidence to bear. They didn't have one witness who was actually in on the call. Not one.
Wishy-washy.
And the whistleblower seems to have been a Democrat Party agent.
Yes.
Whistleblower in inverted commas. Because all of this information was immediately released by Trump. So it's just bizarre. Like, people are falling for this because they're out of ideas, as Pumi says. This is all they've got. So 2020 is going to be very exciting. We can't wait.
Look, guys, just in terms of stuff that's happened this year that I think that, you know, maybe is showing some signs that, you know, things are not going to be quite as bad. Well, I think the stuff that's happened with SAA is probably a good thing. SAA being put into business rescue. And I think it has been real action on the part of government, whether it actually plays out successfully. But I think that that's a starting point. I think that the appointment of ESCOM CEO with that very specific mandate to create three separate business units, again, is a very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now, if it continues in the way it is, you've got no way of actually knowing how to introduce things like independent power producers or green energy and all of that kind of stuff. So, again, I think that's a good thing. We've started seeing for the first time actual arrests coming out from the National Prosecution Authority. And
of people like Bongo at ministerial level. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think that at that level, maybe 2020 is not going to be quite the clusterfuck that 2019 has been.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that.
I will wait to see.
Pumi, there's a comment here for you. Do you not think that it's not the left who's run out of ideas, but the fact that progressivism implies there's never an end to what needs to be fixed or improved, and therefore this means a constant rejection of the status quo, even if the status quo is a pretty good one? That's an interesting thing to leave it on. Something to think about this morning. This is The Burning Platform, brought to you by Nando's on cliffcentral.com. Thank you for joining us.
cliffcentral.com